This is 4:55 on Monday, September 16th. Okay, good morning. Hope it was a good weekend. You kept cool. So today we're going to go over the assignment, the programming assignment. But I thought we'd start with some clicks questions just because there are some aspects of this socket interface that need to become second nature, and doing some of these problems will help with that and help prepare you for the exam. So, the form of the questions here typically is something about the order in which things happen and whether we're on the on the client or the server. So just get your head in the space of all those socket interface operations and think about what order things happen in on the client. Okay, discuss amongst yourselves, please, because things are not... We do not have agreement here. That's what it looks like. The moment for your answers. So what do you think? Go ahead and discuss, you know, don't be quiet. Shall I stop it and restart it? Let me stop it and restart it. Well, didn't. Huh. Okay. Well, doesn't reset the graph. Never mind. Yes, number two. It's the server that binds and listens and accepts. The client connects, right? And once connected, starts sending and receiving. Okay? Next one. So, should be obvious now. Okay. The server does not connect. The server binds, listens, and accepts. Okay, this one takes a little more thought. Server code sends and receives on the socket returned by the socket system call. There's a bit of disagreement there, so let's move to this one. Which system call returns the socket used by the server code for send and receive? Thank you. Okay, which socket system calls return sockets? What's the obvious one? Socket. Okay. Is there another one? Except. Indeed. Those are the only two that return sockets. The others return indicators of whether they succeeded or not. But those two are the ones that return sockets. And in fact, in the server, it's the one returned by except that's used. Okay. How about in the client? Which system call returns the socket used for send and receive in the client? Okay, which socket system calls return sockets? Socket and except. No others. All right? So it's going to be one of those two. And in the client, it's the one returned by socket. Okay? What's the socket returned by the socket system call used for in the server? That's the one on which it listens. Right? So it listens, and then it does an accept call, passing in that original socket, and accept returns additional sockets for actual communication with the client. Yes?
So if the socket for the server is just called socket, and then the socket for the client is just called socket for the different function calls, is there like two different versions basically? So
No, it's not a different version of socket. It's what you do with it after you've got it. So let's go back to the earlier questions, because this is actually a very important point, and it will help to look back at here. So don't answer this. We've already done this one, but let's use it for discussion. So the client socket operate. The clients do these operations, right? They do socket, connect, send, receive, close, right? The client connect operation takes the socket that it's passed and connects it to the socket on the server. Okay? So that when you send and receive, the right things happen. But on the server, just go back here. On the server, the operations are socket, bind, listen, accept, right? So as soon as you say bind on the socket returned by the socket system call, then you've started down the path of setting up things for a server. Okay? So it's not what you say to the socket system call, it's what you do with it afterwards. And that's why it's important to learn these orders, okay, and which ones are appropriate for clients and which for servers. Were there other questions? Good. One more. This one. Which socket-related system calls return immediately? And by immediately here, I mean without waiting for something to happen from the other side. Right, so just based on local things. Okay, there's enough disagreement that I think it's worth discussion. So go ahead and discuss. I see number 4 going up and I don't understand it. Okay, what do we think? Well, which calls involve waiting for something from the other side? Nope, not listen. Accept and connect, right? Listen is just something that you do on the server side to say, I'm ready to listen for connections now. Okay, and then you do an accept, and it's at that point you wait for the client to connect. You look puzzled, Isaac. Okay. So the names are a little weird, I guess, but in fact it's connect and accept that involve waiting for the other side to do something. In the case of accept, you're sitting there in the server in the accept system call, and lots of time could go by, and then eventually a client comes along and says connect, and then the accept will return. But on the client side, the client's going along, it does its socket, and then the second thing it does is connect, and what does it have to wait for? It has to wait for that connection to be established to the server by sending a packet, getting one back. All right? So, it sort of all makes sense if you can sort of let go of your English meanings for words, perhaps. Okay, so those are sort of some of the kinds of questions I ask about this stuff on the exam for, as a word to the wise. Okay. So let's move on. Are there any more questions about that? Did I say that? All right. Let's move on and look at this. So, here we are on the 16th of September, and we're going to talk about Project 1, and later this afternoon I will post the problem assignments from the chapter for chapter 3. You got time to do that. So chapter 1, or project 1 has a roughly 2.5 week interval here. Notice that exam 1 is coming up on the 30th of September. That's 2 weeks from today. And let me say this, although Project 1 is due after Exam 1, you will want to have made significant progress on it before Exam 1 because it will help you learn the stuff that will be on Exam 1. All right. And Chapter 3 is due just on the Friday before the exam, and hopefully having a TA here, we can get those turned around pretty quickly so that you can get them back for studying even though the exam is on Friday. So I'm imposing on Hawk to work on the weekend, but that's what graduate students do, is work all the time. So, all right. Any questions about the schedule? And let's move on to the project. And it continues to be just the pits. Dead in there. Okay, so sign today, due on the 7th, at the end of the day, the usual thing. So we're developing a client and server interacting over TCP. The protocol that I specify here, sort of in English words, uses several different kinds of serialization of data. And that's to give you practice, not only with the sort of network programming interfaces, the socket interfaces, but also the programming techniques that are involved in handling data that comes over a TCP connection. So we'll get into that. So you need to use C for this, please, because this is part of the learning, is to appreciate the pain associated with this stuff. After this, you can use other things that are less painful, but this one is learning the pain and learning the details that comes along with the pain. So, you're going to write a client and a server, and the client program takes in two command line arguments. So hopefully everybody knows how to use argc and argv in C programs to get at the command line arguments, and one of them tells you the name or IP address of the server, and the other one tells you the port. Okay, those are the two things a client needs to know. The server only needs to take in the command line argument. That's the port number, the IP address comes from whatever machine it's running on. In order to simplify things, we're going to just assume that you will start the server first. If the client, if you start the client and it can't connect because the server isn't running, that what you do about that is up to you. I'm not specifying that. Once the server is started, it runs until it's told to go away with a control C signal. I guess on a Windows machine, this would be control Z, would do the same thing. We just essentially kill the server. And it doesn't need to do anything specific to when it exits, it just goes away. One thing that you'll want to pay attention to is that, remember, once a server is listening on a socket, no other server can listen on that socket. So if you have servers that you have running, you'll want to kill them before you start them up again, because otherwise programs will exit. Okay, so here's how it goes. The server does its usual thing, you know, socket, bind, listen, accept. Gets to an accept. The client does the usual thing of socket connect. And so once the client connects, the first thing that happens is that the server sends a string to the client. And notice that it's going to be new line terminated string. Okay? Not a null character terminated. Don't send a null character. There are no null characters sent in this protocol. Okay. So that's one style of sending strings, right? Where it's terminated by a specific character. Another thing to remember about network programming is, and protocols, is that although the protocol specifies what's supposed to happen, the parties to the protocol may not actually obey the protocol. So your client code should check to make sure that the server said the thing that was expected. And if it didn't, it can just close the connection and go away. Right? Server's supposed to say something, it doesn't, then the client had better not trust that the server is any good at all. Okay? So, after receiving that welcome message, the client prompts the user, so there needs to be a little bit of interaction here over standard input, for a name and a 8-digit ID number. And these are then sent to the server as new line terminated strings. Okay. That's the next thing. Okay, next thing. So the server is going to get those, and it's going to have to extract them from the stream that it's receiving. And this is interesting, remember, because the server, in doing its reads, doesn't know how many characters it's going to get, so it's going to have to find the terminators and so forth. So it will do that. And then look up the two of them in a table that you just build into your program. So you can use whatever you want for these ID numbers and names. Just build a table of the ones that you find acceptable into your server program. And when the client sends one of those, you say success, and otherwise you send failure. And the client gets to go around up to 3 times to try to get this right. If the client does that for 3 times, then the server will say, goodbye, I don't want to talk to you because you don't know what you're talking about, and we'll close the socket, and the client should then notice that and give up. Now, how does the client know that the server has closed the connection? When the client reads from a connection, if it gets back 0 bytes read, that means that the server has closed the connection. Actually, it means the party at the other end has closed the connection. Right? So that's how you would find out. Of course, the client will also know that it has gotten failure 3 times, so it could just exit because of that. Okay, so after receiving a success message from the server, the client then prompts the user for another message asking for a password, maximum of 512 characters. This password will be sent to the server by first sending the length as a 2-byte binary number. Okay, so this is the other form of sending strings, where you put the length of the string in front of it. You don't put a terminator at the end. And it's a binary number, and it needs to be in network byte order, which means that you must use the HNS function on the sending side and the NHS on the receiving side. This is not the same way that we did it before, and again, we don't send the null. Okay, the server receives the password, verifies that it matches something in that table that you built, and then either sends congratulations and then uses the name that was sent originally. You've just revealed the password for ID number to the world, because it's the plain text protocol, right? So, not one that you would want to actually use for anything, so I thought it would be good to actually have the protocol include the fact that it was no good. Or it can send the message password incorrect, but in both cases here, it's sending with a length in front of the message rather than a terminator. Okay, and after success, the client prints out the result and exits. If it's failure, it tries a couple more times and then exits. And once the server closes its communication socket with the client, this is the one that it got from accept, so it's going to close it at some point. Once it does that, it goes back and starts accepting another connection. Okay, so this is what's called a single-threaded server. It only handles one client at a time. Later, we will have multi-process or multi-threaded servers and multiplexing servers that can handle more than one client at a time. But for this first one, we'll just keep it simple. So, additional requirements. Check the return values of all system calls and print an appropriate message and exit if an error occurs. Okay, so on either side, client or server, if an error occurs, you can exit. At least as a starting position, you may decide that you want your server in particular to be more robust than that. It's not a requirement, but it might make your life easier. Second thing to remember here is that both send and receive on TCP sockets are allowed to send fewer bytes than requested and to receive fewer bytes than requested. Okay? And you must be prepared to deal with that. Your code must be prepared to deal with that. And I wouldn't be surprised if there are questions about that. So, you know, as you get into this, feel free to bring questions to class about how to do that. It's very important to make sure that the buffers that you pass, particularly to receive operations, are big enough for the number of bytes that you say you're willing to receive. Okay. Extremely important. If you don't do that, your receive operations will smash values in the rest of your program, and your program will behave, shall we say, badly. Okay, so make sure. And the last thing is that if you want to go from a host name or IP address expressed in dotted decimal notation to a value suitable for storing in a struct sock adder in, you can use the library function getAdderInfo. Okay? It exists on both Windows and Unix-y platforms, and there's a man page for it on the web or on your own platform. Let's see here. Yes. There it is. And basically, what you do is you pass into it either the DNS name of the node that you want to talk to, or the IP address as a string. Okay, so quote 192.1. dot 168 dot whatever. You pass in the name of the service. Now we're not going to be using, we're making up our own service here, so we don't want to use the name of a service, but you can also pass in the port number as a string. Okay? So if you choose to run your service on port 5234, you can pass in the string 5234 to get adder info. You can pass null as the hints, that should be fine. And what it returns is a struct adder info, and then it returns a pointer to a list of these struct adder info things, which we have not talked about, but we'll see here in a moment what those look like. Okay, so hints is a way to just restrict the number of answers that this requires, and for what we're doing, passing null or null pointer there will be fine. Here you need to pass the address of a variable to contain the head of the list. Okay. So here's this struct adder info thing. And basically, what you need to do is see that it contains a struct adder, a struct sock adder, which will already be filled in with the IP address and the port number that you passed up there as strings. Okay? So you can just pick this out. Now, it's more complicated because, in fact, what you're getting back is a list of these things. See the AI next field here. So you probably will want to use the first one, but you need to check and make sure that you've got something from the right family and protocol stuff. So let me, I thought I'd just show you, excuse me. Thought I would show you here what this looks like. So this is in Python, but it'll give you a sense of what you get back. Okay, so it says, so we have to look and see what the fields are here. Python simplifies things by converting some of these things. So I'm pretty sure that what it's telling us is that pretty sure that what it's telling us here is that what we have is an IP address, that's the family, IP, and that I don't know what I did there, and that I haven't specified whether it's TCP or UDP, essentially. So which kind of streams, which kind of socket, stream or datagram, and which protocol, UDP or TCP. I didn't specify that, but it is telling me that this is the IP address and this is the port number. Okay, so that, and similar things will happen when you do it with C. Just for grins, I'll show you a more interesting case. So what if we ask for adder info for google.com? Oh, okay. So you get back some different IP addresses in port 80. Oh. Interesting. All right. So this one just gives back different IP addresses in port 80. On my Linux machine, which is IPv6 enabled, it actually came back with a bunch of IPv6 addresses as well as these IPv4 addresses. So anyway, you get back a list of those, probably only one, and then you can use that to fill in your struct sock adder in for the connect and bind operations that you need to do. That will be cool. Any questions about this? So the sense that I think you will get from doing this is that the socket programming dance is relatively straightforward. There are some issues about these sock adder ins and addresses and so forth to worry about, but yeah, that will be fine. Where the struggle will come is with actually reading the data out of the streams, finding the boundaries between messages, and doing the appropriate things with the messages that you get. All right. So watch out. Null characters are not involved in this protocol. So you will want to be careful about that as you figure out how many bytes to send over the connection. And in particular, you'll want to be careful about that when you receive things, because you're not going to be receiving any null characters. So if you do things like strcomp on things that are in the receive buffer, things are going to go wild because there are no null characters in there, right? So you got to sort of pay attention to what you're doing here. Questions? So please feel free to bring questions about this to class or to Hawk during the time that this is assigned, and do get started on it early because people struggle with this kind of programming when they first get into it. So it's not terribly difficult, but it's got a lot of details to worry about. So with that then, let's move on and start to talk about Chapter 3, which connects very nicely at this point to just what we've been talking about. So this is the transport layer. And we've talked about transport layer now in sort of Chapter 1, just in the abstract. We've talked about it concretely in terms of the socket interfaces for making communications happen, and now we'll get into the details. So the goals for the chapter are to sort of learn in principle about multiplexing and demultiplexing. We'll talk about what that means. In principle, about reliable data transfer, flow control, and congestion control. These are the functions of the transport layer in general. And then to talk specifically about the transport layer protocols for the internet, UDP and TCP, and I'm going to try to add in something about SCTP since that was recommended. So we'll see what we can learn about that. So what are the services of the transport layer? They're in order to understand the service of the transport layer, you have to remember what the service of the network layer is, which we haven't really talked about in detail yet, but we did mention it in Chapter 1. So what does the network layer do? What is its primary service?
It transports information.
It transports information from where to where?
From one host to another.
Okay? So one of the functions of the transport layer, adding on to what the network layer it sits over is providing, is to provide communication between processes running on the hosts. The network layer takes care of getting it to the host. The transport layer, which is implemented inside the host, takes care of getting it to the right process. So that's one, that's sort of the principal job, and then we'll talk about the various kinds of ways it can do that. So the transport protocol code runs in the end systems. When you send data from one end system to another end system, that data is not inspected at the transport layer by the intermediate hosts. And I will say, in principle, it's not inspected by the intermediate hosts. What reasons might there be for the intermediate host to actually look at things at the transport layer?
Sometimes have to decide how to route them, like where to go next, or is that?
No, that's network layer functionality. Okay. What reasons might there be for something sort of here in the network layer before you get to the end host? Two things. Firewalls, right, which are sort of in the network layer from the perspective of the end systems, and NAT, network address translation, also involves looking at transport layer. So both of those things are sort of impure network layer components because they look at transport layer stuff. But principally, the transport layer stuff is at the end systems. The sending side breaks up the messages coming down from the application layer that we just finished talking about into what are called segments, and passes those on to the network layer, where the network layer puts them into datagrams. And on the receive side, we reassemble the segments into messages and pass to the application layer, pass upward to the application layer, and in the internet, TCP and UDP and SCTP, as we talked about. So, how to understand the transport layer versus the network layer? It's sort of like what happens when the mail arrives at your house, right? You have a bunch of people living in your house. The post office just delivers the mail to your mailbox, and then somebody from inside the house has to pick up that mail and distribute it out to all the people who live there. Okay? There are other functions of the transport layer. Remember that the network layer that we're working with here in the internet is unreliable, best effort datagram delivery, right? So the network layer over which this thing is living is going to throw out data. It's going to reorder data. It may even corrupt data. And the transport layer's job is to fix all those things and present a model to the applications, in the case of TCP, of reliable in-order delivery. In addition, in the case of TCP, we have congestion control, which we talked about when Bob Radin was here, the importance of making sure that the applications are not sort of overloading the network. Flow control, which is, seems related but is different. Flow control is the property that the sender doesn't overrun the receiver of the data, slows down when the receiver gets behind. And the connection setup is sort of an auxiliary function that you need to go through in order to enable the rest of this. The UDP protocol really doesn't do anything to the IP protocol, the network layer protocol, except provide for the delivery to the end processes instead of end hosts. And none of this provides any delay guarantees or bandwidth guarantees or anything like that. So, multiplexing and demultiplexing. The problem is that we have, from the network layer perspective, we just have the ability to send from one host to another host. And we need to add something to get us from one application to another application. And to do that, what we do is we add some header information, which is called the transport header, to the data that's coming down from the application. So the application says, here's my data. The transport layer is going to associate that data with coming from a particular application or in actual fact from a particular socket by sticking a number on it that says this information came from this socket. And what is that number that it sticks on there? That's the port number. Okay. So what am I seeing here? So we stick on that number when it comes over here. We know where it came from. Well, we also stick on where it's going in terms of the socket it's destined for. The receiver, this is a really bad slide. They did not improve this slide in going from the previous version of this slide to this slide, to this version. Let me tell you, this is not easy to see. What we're seeing here is a decision made at the transport layer in this circle to either send the incoming data that way or that way. Not good. So, when receiving, of course you get this segment contained inside a datagram, And we'll talk next about the network layer, where we talk about the IP addresses that are involved in the datagrams. But in the segment, we have a source port and a destination port. This is true for both TCP and UDP. And so the when you have this decision about the incoming data, about where is it going to go, you're going to look at some combination of the destination port, the source port, the destination address, and the source address, and figure out who it belongs to. And in the case of UDP, you just look at the port number, but in the case of TCP, oh, we got an example of this. I want to go ahead. Sorry, get a race ahead. In the case of TCP, you look at all four of those things, all four bits of information, to decide which socket you're going to deliver a given message to. Okay? So now I'll back up to my clever animation here. So we have a datagram socket living here, and it's and another one over here. They have maybe the same port number, the same different port numbers, it doesn't matter. They're on different hosts. In the middle, we have somebody who's got a datagram socket with port number 6428. If he sends something destined to port 6428, that's where it goes. Okay. And similarly. All right. So with datagram sockets, the port number associated with that socket is all there is to determine which socket it goes to. With TCP, things are a lot more complicated, and you'll want to actually get this and get this chart and study it, because you know, I could walk through it, but even if I walk through it, you're not going to get it. You got to walk through it for yourself. So depending on the source IP address, source IP port, destination IP address, and destination IP port, the transport layer here will send to any of those three sockets, even though all three of them have the same port number. Okay? All three of those have port 80. But because the messages are coming from different IP addresses and different port numbers, they end up going to different sockets. So you want to look into that. Okay. So next time we will talk about UDP. That won't take us very long. And then we will move straight into talking about principles of reliable data transfer, which will take us quite a while because that's a complicated subject. Hello.
If any children could add to this class, could I add to this class at any time?
Could you add this class? Have you been coming?
Yeah, but I'm not registered.
You're not registered, but you have been coming. Mm-hmm. Have you been doing the homework?
No. I was submitted tonight. But the thing is to do is through email. Can I submit to you today for the homeworks?
For the homeworks? We'll send them to Hawk. I think his name is on the website now. If not, send them to me. So why are you adding so late?
I'm working with Nancy that previously planned to go someplace else for this semester, but it's canceled now.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
So you're what you had planned for the semester is not happening. Well, I suppose, I mean, you're behind.
Yeah.
Let me turn off this.